24 and 25. As we get started, please pass your outline forward for this last half, for the last half of Exodus. We're dealing with the theocratic form of the covenant. We've seen that it's established. The people are sealed by the blood of the covenant. And now we proceed right on with the divine legislation for covenant worship in the theocratic setting. The divine legislation for covenant worship in the theocratic setting. We really should begin with verse 9 of chapter 24. We have a revelation of the God to be worshipped. The God who has now made himself known as a covenant God, as a loving God, gives another revelation of himself, and now specifically as the God of glory. It's striking the way the Bible's organized. It sure makes good sense, class. Just before we go into now all these regulations for worship, the sanctuary, the priesthood, the sacrifices, and all the and how all of life is to be an act of worship in the last part of Leviticus, here we get this revelation of God. First of all, to whom? Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu. That is Nadab and Abihu, the two men who were to be the two assistant priests of the high priest, and the 70 elders. Notice the 70 elders definitely represent organization and representation here for the whole congregation, the leaders and the representatives. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not reach out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. They beheld God and they lived. They ate and they drank. This is a most unique little passage here, and it's far too brief to do much with. Oh, can give us a lot of questions, because no man shall see God and live. Later on in chapter 33, we read of Moses fading to see God. Chapter 34. Last part of 33 and 34, and then God says, oh, look, you can only see more or less the backside, goodness and mercy and grace, all this. And yet here there is just this outright statement, they beheld God. And yet God is a spirit, no man can behold him. Just how God made himself known here, we do not know. It is not stated. Yet these men received a revelation of God, a view of God, and they lived. Then, verses 12 to 18, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me in the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses went up to the mountain. Joshua, too, accompanied him evidently part of the way, all the way, and then returned. Somehow Joshua just has a way of evaporating at times. To the elders he said, wait for us here until we return to you. And then he made Aaron and Hur, another son of Aaron, to be basically in charge. And the elders were to report to Aaron and Hur. And Moses went up to the mountain. And there's that other revelation of the glory of God. Verse 16. And the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai. The cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. Now verse 17. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of God was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. There was something awesome. Again. And later on, the Hebrews picks up this phrase. Remember, our God is a consuming fire. And we find this out, too, that a few times this comes through, this consuming aspect of God. The glory of God becomes an awful thing for the disobedient one. Well, before we go into regulations of worship, God reveals himself again as a most glorious God with the aspect of the consuming fire. Is this to scare people? No. This is to impress the people with the majesty and the holiness of God. And in Leviticus, you read it again and again. I am the Lord your God. I am holy. to impress the people with this God who had come to them, remember? But he didn't come to them as a buddy-buddy. He came to them as Lord. He came to them to be their helper, to be their companion, to be their husband, their lover. But he didn't come to be profane, to be common, to be lowly, to be one that we can just treat as we treat an angel. God maintained his character as God, even though he has come down to deliver, though he's taken them as an eagle on his back, and though he's identified himself with them by the blood of the covenant, he remains God, and worship him as such, and serve him as such. Moses on the mountaintop, and now this worship, which is to be the worship of the glorious God, is to be centered in the sanctuary. And in chapter 5, 25, we get the regulation concerning the sanctuary. We want to just take up a few of the points here. The materials, God doesn't just, with the magic wand, whoop them up, and there it is. No. Free will offering. This is a covenant venture, you know. This is a, if I'm in your midst, I'll be represented in your midst, but your part is contribute now freely. And the interesting thing is that when we get to this whole body of legislation, the last chapter of Leviticus, again, it deals with a free will offering. If you give, make sure it's a gift. The price isn't so important, but oh, that voluntary gift. The tithe comes through, no doubt about it, but oh, that voluntary gift. How God does prize that. And now when he's going to dwell in the midst, no conscription, no taxation, no leveling of quotas. Tell the people to give. And the people gave freely. And the purpose is, as we read here, that God may dwell among them. Verse 8, and let them construct a sanctuary for me. That does not mean that they have to get in there with their own hands. No, they construct by giving. God will later on appoint his own qualified workmen. But that I may dwell among them, that God may indeed be God with them, that they might have a real definite evidence that this holy God, this terrifying God, this loving God, is in their midst. He's not going to be in their midst in just a common, usual way. Oh no, he's going to have a special place where his presence will be centered. The pattern to be provided by God in verse 9, to be strictly followed. Not just a general pattern. Oh, the details. Didn't that get a bit boring in your reading? Did any of you try to sit there and kind of start scratching it out as to what the thing had looked like? Aren't you enough of an artist for that? Or an architect? Frankly, I quit picked up my new dictionary of the Bible and new Bible dictionary and got the courtyard and the tabernacle before me again too, because reading is so much easier. You have that little sketch right alongside. You know what it's all about. Now the pattern to be followed. First of all, the ark. Very ornate, verses 10 through 22. The testimony to be within it. The revelation of God. The written word. The written word to be in it. About the book. The cherubs, over the top, and this is the gold mercy seat, and here is where the presence of God is to center. There I will meet. The point of meeting is right there. Between the cherubim, above the testimony, the written word. Men are to approach. Later on we find that they come there once, the sprinkling of the blood. Second, verses 23 to 30, the table, also very ornate, gold. And notice how regulations were made immediately too, as to how for transport, how they were to be carried by poles, rings in it right away, because these things were to be handled by hand as little as possible. And then, by the way, the first part of the book of Numbers, you know, carefully details who has to carry the different parts. If you've understood a little bit the different aspects of the tabernacle, the first part of Numbers really becomes simple, because the different parts are now being apportioned to the different sons of Levi and their clan for carrying. What is to be placed on it? The utensils to be used for offering are on this table, and the bread of the presence. My. What a lot of talk. What a lot of writing one can pick up on what the bread of the presence is. Is it the manna? No, later on we read the manna is also, when the manna quits, the bottle goes inside of here, alongside the testimony. What is the bread of the presence? Later on we find out that there's a loaves of bread that come there. God reveals his presence also evidently as the God who provides, the God who cares. The bread, you'll know that God is present through the fact that your daily needs are provided through the basic staples that are necessary. I think it's as simple as that, but others have seen a lot more here, and it's amazing what imagination some have come up with. I mean, products of imagination. And then verses 37 following, 31 to 37, that beautiful lampstand. Again, I'd like to see somebody try to follow this one out with the bulb and the cup and the almond blossom and so on and so forth. It's quite obvious that there was that central pole that came right on with on the base, and then it had the branches. That part is not too difficult, is it? Wait a minute. I got three there. I got... This is what we want. Somehow cups at the top with flowers, and then this one has one with a kind of a flower shield. Evidently, there was a kind of a shield back on top of here that would throw the light forward. That the blossom, almond blossom, beautiful white fragrant little flower, the petal had been the shape of an almond petal, and that would reflect the light so that the light would be cast forward, because later on in the day, the light always had to come forward. And this lamp had to be burning perpetually, had to be kept lit all the time. Special beaten olive oil, we read, had to be prepared for this, so that comes later. Anyway, first of all, the details for the actual construction of this. Now, these are the three main parts, the ark, the table, and the lampstand. Later on, we read about the making of a little altar or box for the incense, but first, these three major things are prescribed. Then the tabernacle itself, in chapter 26. And this is to be done by skillful workmen. Skillful workmen, the material from all, but only the skill of the skillful. The sides of the curtain with loops, and then, again, I suppose some of you have seen these tents, but in Australia, and in the Australian Army, always have the double tent. You know what I mean by double tent? Did you gather this? Did you read this and figure out what this other tent was? First, you know, they make the... it could be that the top of the tabernacle itself was flat. And then it was 20 feet high. And then there had to be that covering over it like this. You've seen some of these tents this way, haven't you, on camping grounds? Does he have a double cover? Or who has not seen that? We've all seen that. You haven't. You haven't. I see. First, I thought maybe you all had. I come from California. I have seen it there too. That people get a tent, and then they also get a tent cover for that, because it makes it so much cooler. The tent stays so much cooler by having another cover over it. And then the air flows freely through there. Oh, it makes it. I have to make it 20 degrees cooler in a tent by just having another little canvas over the top, just so the air can get between there. It works on the principle of an attic, huh? Only we foolishly go over and tow the attic and take away the effect of the cooling effect of an attic, unless, of course, we've got good louvers and fans blowing the hot air out. But anyway, to keep that place from becoming a terribly hot place in the desert, they had to put the Lord's cover over it, the tent cover. That's in verse 7.
The first part.
The first part of verse 7. That's that little tent covering
over the tabernacle.
Then it goes on again to talk about the curtain for the entire tabernacle, verses 7b to 13. The top of the tabernacle had to be beautifully red.
Red.
Yes, I think it's that curtain that had to be red. The goat's hair curtain. Then, what would keep these big curtains, these 20-foot curtains, standing?
They had to have boards. Boards at the corner, they had to have two of them. But then they had 20 boards, 20 feet long.
Doesn't mean that they had a solid wall, but no, just boards that kept the tabernacle up, 20 of them. And on the back side, and by the way, these were 10 cubits long, so that's about 18 feet high. And then 20 on each side, 6 on the back. It doesn't say anything yet about the east side, the front. There had to be locking bars. That what kept the boards up were bars from one board to the next. And then there had to be one long, slender one again that fit over the top of that one to lock everything together. So it was a pretty well interlocked affair without a nail in the whole place, with hooks and loops and catches and whatnot, but the thing stood, even in the desert storm. Then, verse 31, the veil of blue and purple by skillful man hanging on four poles of acacia, and it had to have a special clasp. And again, the poles inside had to have a bit of a hook on it so that the curtain barbs could be in there and the curtain could catch onto that. The minutest detail, all laid out. God talking to Moses on the mount. This veil was to partition the tabernacle. As you know, the tabernacle was... This would be square, and this then would be twice as long as it's wide. The Holy of Holies with the curtain in between. 18 feet high, 30 feet long, 10 by 10. I think that's what it was. Well, and in front, verses 36 and 37, they had 5 pillars with a special type of an opening screen. Now in chapter 26, starting at verses 1 to 19, we get the whole the court outside the tabernacle. That's quite a place. That's half as big as a football field. And that had to be completely curtained in also, the entire court. So sometimes you wondered, what did all those Levites do? I tell you, when they were moving, those boys were packing a load. They sure were, because it all had to be carried by hand. Some of them could be put on wagons. But a half a football field, 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, this outside court completely surrounded by curtains, and all the poles and the bars and everything else to keep that up and to keep it up firmly and keep it standing. An altar had to be made in the court, 5 cubits by 5 cubits, so that's 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet by 4.5 feet of wood. It had to be hollow inside with a net grate over the top. Utensils of bronze had to be made, again, hooks along the sides so they could be properly carried, and that had to stand right here, the opening. Again, this is the east side, over at the opening here of the tabernacle. That's where the great altar was to be put. And the last thing we read here in chapter 26 is that there was to be a perpetual light. The last part of chapter 27. A perpetual light. Going on to chapter 28 now. Having received the legislation for the ark, the courtyard, and the altar, by the way, is a very important thing. Later on we read of a laver that comes in here, but just like we had the table here, the lampstand here, the ark, and then the holy place there, and the altar here, these are the basic things that are first laid out. Now, who is to lead in worship? The priest. So, if my first point under this point was the revelation of the glory of God, centered in the sanctuary, conducted by the priest. This covenant worship in the theocratic setting was to be led and conducted by the priest, Aaron and his four sons. Now, their dress. Well, I'm not going to go into the detail here. The ephod, the breastplate, the robe, the sash. Quite a thing. It was to be a garment of beauty. Holy for glory and beauty. Verse 2. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother. For glory and for beauty. Not for Aaron's glory. Not for Aaron's beauty. God wants worship to be beautiful. He's a glorious God. He wants everything made out beautifully, in a setting of beauty, and his servants have to reflect God's glory and God's honor. They who will stand between must give evidence of the fact that they represent the people before a glorious God, and they represent a glorious and a wonderful God to the people. And their dress must reflect it. Again, skillful people have to prepare it. People who are wholly consecrated, verse 3, and that's the only way that Aaron can properly worship. Then the various elements, the tunic, the turban, the sash, the breastplate, the ephod, the robe. The only thing I want to call attention to is that there are, in verse 15, the 12 stones in the breastplate representing the 12 children of Israel, but it's also called the breastplate of judgment, a breastplate of representation and of judgment. They are represented graciously before God. At the same time, it's called judgment. The justice of God is never left out of the picture in the worship setting. The Urim and Thummim, which we use later, and there's quite a bit of discussion too as to just how the Urim and the Thummim operated. It seems like they were two stones that were loose that could be taken, and when sometimes the will of God was sought, the Urim and the Thummim would be consulted, whether it was something like the rolling of a dice, or just seeing if he'd go forward and came back just to see how the stones would hang. There's all kinds of conjecture and theories about how these two stones really function in helping people determine the way on the way of the Lord in a specific situation. Because that's when the Urim and Thummim were consulted. When a man really didn't know what to do, and he knew he had to move on. And there were two equal before him. Consult the Urim and Thummim. A few times in case of judgment, when the Lord's will was not known, then it was sought. Notice in verse 41 that they are to be anointed. I mean Aaron and his sons. Pour oil on them. In the Old Testament, we read of the priest being anointed. It's the prophet who's anointed, and it's the king who is anointed. And if they're anointed by a specially prepared oil, and again, oil becomes a symbol, as we read further in the Old Testament, definitely of the Spirit of God. They are qualified to serve when they're anointed because they are given the symbol of the Spirit. No worship, no qualified servant without the enabling work of the Spirit. So much for what they were to look like. How were they to be prepared? They had to go through a whole ritual. Remember, this was all being prescribed in chapter 29. That whole ordination service was the most elaborate one. A bull, two rams, and unleavened bread had to be provided. They had to be washed. Verse 4, bring Aaron and his sons to the doorway of the tent of meeting and wash them. Before they were to be dressed, be thoroughly washed, and then put the garments on them, one by one. Then comes the bull, verse 10. The bull has to be sacrificed, and the two goats have to be sacrificed. You read of that in verse 15 and 19. That before the bull and the two goats are to be sacrificed, what takes place? They lay their hands. The priest, if they're to be in the ritual consecration, has to lay their hands on the heads of these animals. Here's that whole concept of substitution coming through, a vicarious passing on of their sin. And once the head of the bull had been loaded with the sin of these men, then the bulls were offered. The blood of the bull had to go on the altar. The blood of the first ram had to go around the altar. And the blood of the second ram had to go on the lobe of the ear of the priest, on the thumb, on the right thumb, and on the toe. Who of you caught that? Covered by the blood. The head, the body, the leg, or the hand, the head, the hand, and the foot. It doesn't say soak them in blood. No, just put some blood. The all important thing is the contact. It's not a matter of a case of being completely covered. The lobe, the thumb, and the toe. And thus they would be completely consecrated to the Lord. Then we look at verse 38 of chapter 29. After the prescription has been given as to how the priests are to be dressed and how they are to be prepared for worship, their daily duty is set forth immediately. Every morning and every evening there shall be the sacrifice of rams, sheep. But morning and evening, the way open to meet with God, verses 42 to 46, a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet you to speak to you there. The morning and evening, the way had to be kept open by the blood of sacrifice. That's the point. There was no approaching God. There was not a thought of approaching God. For a covenant people sealed by blood without the blood of the sacrifice. And the writer in Hebrews picks up that same concept again. It's because of the fact that Jesus Christ, who has once offered himself fully, he's an open door to heaven. We don't have to sacrifice these rams every morning and evening anymore, because he, the Lamb of God, has shed his blood once and for all, and we may enter boldly to the throne. Because why? The shed blood is there. He opens the way to us. Going on to chapter 30, the ingredients for the worship ritual. Additional ingredients. Here we get, first of all, that incense altar, which is to be placed. When the priest begins to do his work, there's to be an incense altar right here. Right where they go through the opening into the Holy of Holies, in front of the veil, and there's never to be strange incense on this altar. On this incense altar. Notice that right now, because we get to Leviticus 10. We'll see what tragedy happens when this prescription is not carried out. Once a year, when men are to go through, they're to go through into here, this is prescribed into, and then they are to particularly pay attention as to how they are to offer on this altar. And when then there's reference to the people having to give their contribution again to, and then there's reference to the people having to give their contribution again to, and this again is a gift, but now it's prescribed. Everyone, be he rich, be he poor, gives a half shekel. The equality of every person had to be recognized too. No one, when he comes before God, really is worth more than anyone else. This is right in the context of when he goes in to the presence of God to represent the people, then everybody comes with his half shekel. Be he rich, be he poor. Equal representation is a basic principle there. And then the ingredients for the anointing oil, the last part of chapter 30. Man, that must have been some rich, powerful stuff. I can well imagine why they sing in Psalm 133. It's like the fragrance of Aaron after he's had the oil thrown on his head and it drips out of his beard. You can just see the waves of fragrance, you know, just radiating forth. And people with sinus trouble might have had a little problem staying close around the air. Yeah. And then we get on to chapter 31, and who is to take care of this? The specially prepared man. And notice here that the gifts of the Spirit, these are the gifts of the Spirit. And what are they? Skill. Able to make ornate vessels. Able to make ornate clothes. Able to make beautiful woven curtains. I have filled him, verse 3, with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and knowledge and in all kinds of craftsmanship to make artistic designs for work in gold. I have filled him with the Spirit of God. And here we get that media teaching again, too, that our talents and our gifts, etc., and so on, are never to be taken in separation from the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God is a beautifier, as we saw in chapter 1, verse 1 of Genesis. But even in our daily life, in our work, don't separate your gifts and your skills and your talents from the Spirit of God endowing you, enabling you, strengthening you to carry out your specific skills. Notice that everybody isn't equally skilled. It's Bezalel, yeah. Son of Uri, the tribe of Judah. He is especially the Spirit-filled one in regard to these specific gifts. The gift of craftsmanship. And the Lord puts it to work. And there's another one in verse 5. I've appointed with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. And in the hearts of all who are skilled, I have put skill. So it's not Bezalel who is to do it all himself, but he's a master skill. And then he's got one under him whom the Lord has qualified, and all the others who have skill, put him to work. But he wants skilled craftsmanship. It's not a matter of sloppiness, or, you know, just do it, anybody can do it, and so on and so forth. No. Everybody can give. Everybody can worship. But when it comes to certain specific tasks, God looks for the skilled ones. And put the skilled ones to work. This is Old Testament regulation. The time for this is when? Read verse 13 of chapter 31. But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall surely observe my Sabbath, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. And then, in verse 15, a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Verse 16, so the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath, to celebrate the Sabbath throughout the generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. Keeping the Lord's day is a real covenant duty. That's the point. It's a real integral part of your living relationship with the Lord, Old Testament people. You may say, oh, but this is the old theocracy. This is the theocratic setting, that's true. But before the theocracy was formed, we saw already that they couldn't go out and pick up their manna. You know, this insistence on this day, on this one day for the Lord, that you drop your work. And that you become refreshed, that you become physically relaxed, and that you really are busy celebrating, as the term comes up a little bit later. Oh, this, God insists on this, right on, right throughout. You're going to work properly 6 days. You better see to it that you get some good refreshment, good relaxation. And the best way to really get refreshed and invigorated is enter into the worship of God. Dropping all the things. The worship of the Lord. So again, in all the stipulation that comes here, the time. And the law is given in writing. Notice in verse 18, verse 31, and when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the tablets of the testimony. Well, so far for all the stipulations concerning worship. Now, as a subpoint under this, I have the violation of worship. And we have the tragedy of chapter 32. I think it's well that you remember chapter 32 in Exodus also. Chapter 32 to 34, the violation of worship. Moses is barely gone and the people want their idols. They want a God they can see. Aaron is a compromiser. Really, Aaron compromises. He goes to work and makes a golden calf for him. But he doesn't feel right about it. So here we read that the next morning he quick had the people gather around the altar. And so they all came around the altar. And they pay their respects to the Lord. And as soon as, boy, they got that over with quick in the morning. And the rest of the time, that's where they were dancing to gather the male and the female. And after they went through all their orgies, and the wrath of God rose to the highest heaven. May well be that what's described here, because it's the noise, the sound of the singing. And the reason the Lord was so highly, highly angry with these is because of the fact that they had corrupted themselves verse 7. It's something they're doing that they're doing. They're involved in corruption and Egyptian idol worship. And all, and if everything that goes along with Egyptian idol worship, well, there was immorality of all kinds, sexual orgy, was a real integral part of much of Egyptian worship. They have corrupted themselves. They have turned quickly aside from the way I have commanded. I'm going to blot them out. And then we find Moses coming through as the intercessor, pleading not that the people be excused, but pleading that God remembers his word, his covenant, his grace. And we read that God repented himself of the evil that he intended to do. And the thing that's very interesting in chapter 32 is that when Moses intercedes, God does not take his wrath away, because in the latter part of the chapter we see that his wrath is still executed on 3,000 people who fell that very day. And a pestilence struck amongst the people, and many more fell. The wrath of God was still present. But it didn't come out on the whole crowd. The wrath of God was stayed against the whole congregation by Moses' intercessory prayer. But when Moses gets down off the mountain, by the way, he does lose his head, and he loses the tablets of the stone too. In his anger, he crashes it. He kind of, in a way, he almost sounds like he's trying to reprimand God for God getting angry up in the mountain when he hadn't seen yet what was going on down there. But when he sees it, he loses everything. And he runs down there, and he takes Aaron to task. And then he says, who is on the Lord's side? Who is on the Lord's side? And all those that indicated they're on the Lord's side, especially the tribe of Levi, they become agents again of purification. 3,000 fall at the hand of those that are on the Lord's side, and the Lord strikes directly with a pestilence. Oh, the wrath of God remained. The justice of God was executed. But at the same time, the grace of God came through so beautifully when Moses, the Redeemer, becomes Moses the interceder. And the wrath of God is diverted. The wrath of God is stayed for a time, and it's diverted from all those who repent and all those who take side with the Lord. Those that say, sorry, Lord, we don't want to be part of that whole crowd. Well, then in chapter 33, we get the interim period. Now, this chapter 33 has caused untold difficulty for many commentators, Bible readers, etc., and so on. Please remember, Moses was up on the mountain. He'd been given the tables of law. God says, I'm going to wipe out these people. But there's a stay of God's wrath. But God's wrath does come through part of the congregation. Now, the tables are thrown or broken. Moses seems to be in the quandary. What do I do now? Do I proceed? And the first part that we get in the chapter 33 is that God says, depart, go up, you and your people whom I brought up from Egypt, to the land I swore, to the descendants flowing. But I will not go with you. Verse 3, I will not go up in your midst, because you're an obstinate people, lest I destroy you on the way. Go on, move, go your way. You see, God was perturbed with this quick violation of his covenant. Remember in chapter 23, 24, before Moses went up to the mountain to get detailed instruction, it had been laid out. Today, an altar, worship only God. They had immediate provision. They flouted it off. So Moses pleads with the Lord, and what does Moses do? He goes outside the camp a ways in verse 7. And now Moses took a tent and pitched it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. This is during that interim period between his two going to the mountain. And God is not in the midst of his people. God can be consulted outside the camp. And it came about that everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of the meeting, which was outside the camp. And it came about whenever Moses went out to the tent that all the people would arise and stand, each at the entrance of the tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. And it came about whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. This is during that interim period. This is not the normal procedure. Many people say that the Old Testament is all balled up here again. that it has this picture, you know, of the tabernacle, and then it's got another tent of the meeting way outside. This is the tent of the meeting that was during the interim period. God didn't completely forsake his people, but he wasn't in their midst then either. God took this violation of his worship very seriously, and he wanted to impress this upon the people. You just don't go to work and violate without consequences. Then at the close of the chapter, Moses pleads that he may receive assurance that God is indeed a God of the people, that he is indeed designated Moses to be a leader of these people. In a way, Moses says, God, I've got to start all over again after this terrible debacle here. Because when I went up in the mountain, things just completely got out of my hands. Things got completely out of control. And what does God do? And then God comes to Moses and he says, I can't see you. You can't see me face to face. No. After this, there's not a second time of seeing face to face. But you can see me from behind. You'll see my glory passing by. Chapter 33, verse 22. And then Moses went up on the rock again the next morning. After this, and God passed by. But it isn't so much what Moses heard. I mean, what Moses saw then. It's what Moses heard. And there was that voice that declared, chapter 34, verse 6, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting iniquity of the fathers. There is the grace of God magnified, and the justice of God clearly stipulated. God, the God of love, is a God of love and grace. He's a God of justice. He will not wink at sin. He will not clear the guilty, the unrepentant guilty one, and say, forget it, forget it. Oh, he will graciously forgive. A God oh so patient, oh so tender and compassionate, oh abounding in loving kindness. That's God. But he will not forgive the wicked. In chapter 34, then, as we go through here, then we see in verse 8 and 9, I'll pick it up here after a while. Let's have our break first.